Hi everyone, welcome to another episode. I thought the most interesting thing that I've read this week was Microsoft's plans to dramatically increase their data centers. So I've been following what we're doing. We're very optimistic, along with many others, about the future of semiconductors. And the reason for that is that we basically know the investment plans of the hyperscalers. We know there's going to be a huge amount of investment, and it's all going to land in a few companies who obviously are then going to invest a lot of that themselves. So we know the chips will be made by Taiwan Semiconductor. They'll be on ASML machines. They'll mostly be NVIDIA chips, with AMD as a heavily fostered number two, particularly by Meta and Microsoft. But the scale of it is still quite impressive. So we read from one hyperscaler, they have 192 data centers, and they're planning to build 110 this year. And over the next 4 years, 120 to 130 a year. So 60, 70 increase each year on what they have today. And so if they have 192 today, they're planning to have 900 by 2028. So under 200 to 900 in a few years, because it's very scary, but we're a quarter of the way through 2024. So that's only 4 years away, and that's a huge uplift. That's a 4x uplift. That's going to require immense spend on NVIDIA and AMD. It's going to require immense spend Taiwan Semiconductor, the wires to wire all these up, the data transfer, the cleaning, all the technology pieces that fit into that are going to go through a multi-year boom. And the reality is we still haven't seen the full impact of AI. You know, we've just scratched the surface, especially because there's a race on AI models to get better and better. The publicly available ones still basically don't have any memory. The OpenAI's GPT-4 has been around for quite some time now. GPT-5 will be immensely more computationally intense. There was a great web app released this week, which was Suno, which is so far the best AI music generator. So there's been AI music generators, but this one seems to be the best implementations. And again, you just ask it to write a song about Tamarama Beach or something, and it will come up with something pretty decent. Lyrics, structure, can be done in many different styles, but you still kind of press the button and then wait, and somewhere a GPU is spinning up, maybe even a group of GPUs, and is processing all of that, with each note and each word, you know, depending on all the other notes and parts of the song previously. The same way that Sora, with their text to video, has somehow built like a physics engine unintentionally, but every pixel in every frame is aware of every other pixel in every other frame. So if you think about the computation to generate one extra tiny pixel on that screen, it has to be aware of everything that's happened in the past. So the context length for these models is getting absolutely enormous, and that's going to require immense amounts of memory and very advanced chips. It's going to require lots of data to be shifted inside these data centers in between GPUs and different parts of the GPUs. That model hasn't even been released yet. You know, it hasn't even been used. There's no users using it. It's just a handful of early testers and OpenAI. So the real demand shock is still to come. I found that really interesting in the context of what Microsoft was doing in terms of going from 192 data centers to 900. So you can have fairly high conviction on that spend and very high conviction on the handful of companies that it's going to land on. I thought also it was interesting to take a look at ARM. So ARM is a stock that we didn't really find that interesting. I mean, first it was just growing at 14%. So mid-teens growth, which for a company that is trying to pitch itself as an AI stock is not particularly impressive. You know, the last year NVIDIA has gone up, has grown revenues by well over 200%. So to only do 14, 15% and pitch yourself as an AI company shows you that your revenues aren't really being driven by the explosion of AI applications that have come over the last year. So already pretty skeptical on that part. But I thought I'd take another look at it because it had this huge rip after last quarter. I think it was one of the first major IPOs, and so it came on the books without the usual enthusiasm that comes with IPOs in, you know, mid and late cycle. But it doesn't have a lot of short interest, and it came out with a solid result, spoke a lot about AI and more than doubled. It's now like a $120 billion company doing, say, $800 million of revenue in a quarter. You know, it's trading at 40 times sales at mid-teens growth. It just doesn't seem to make much sense. Like, it's way out of whack relative to the rest of semis. It's also a really interesting story because, you know, Intel was the one that should have had ARM's market. So Steve Jobs went to Intel and basically offered for them to do the chip, and they didn't think there would be enough demand to justify the investment. And obviously the rest is history. All mobiles now basically run on ARM architecture, which has been a phenomenal missed opportunity for Intel amongst many. And it's doubly ironic because it was Andy Grove of Intel that had that famous catchphrase, "Only the paranoid survive." And they seem to have just made major strategic error after major strategic error. And then the other interesting thing is, like, why couldn't they catch up? And it turns out it's a common theme in semiconductors that it's so important to capture the market because you need the revenues to drive the investment to be on the leading edge. And that is kind of what Intel missed out on. To give you an example, you know, like, the US government used to have fabs. They used to make semiconductors for defense. And you can imagine the advantage of having your own fab. You can do their own designs. You can have full control over the process. There's no risk of any backdoors slipping in. But even the US government didn't have enough scale. And really, one way of looking at the market is that the technology is so advanced, so capital intensive, and so difficult that you need the entire planet's demand to justify the spend required and the specializations required all across the supply chain to make leading-edge chips today. And really, effectively, all that lands in Taiwan Semiconductor. It is the only company that can build the advanced chips on the scale that the world needs. And even if you're the US government or you're Intel or you're Samsung, it's extremely difficult to catch up with that, which is kind of why, like, we have that saying that all roads lead to Taiwan Semiconductor. It's also worth noting that Taiwan Semiconductor is the cheapest company out of most of those semiconductors. You know, it's a forward P of 18 times versus, say, ARM, which is 1,500 times PE, but really 42 times EV sales is probably the right way to look at it. But at least you can see the upside in Taiwan Semiconductor, whereas I just don't see it in ARM, because remember, they're mobile, and mobile is a fully saturated market. People, upgrade cycles are going down. I think the only near-term hope for mobile is that Apple is going to release their own work on what they've done with AI and potentially upgrade Siri. And maybe that gives people a reason to upgrade and to be really excited about the new iPhone the way they used to be. But in the meantime, you know, the form has basically stayed the same. If you want a bigger screen or smaller screen, it's available. The battery is a pretty decent trade-off for all the high-performance computing that's going on. Camera is as good as you really need it to be. You know, it's extremely high resolution movies front and back. You know, the feature set is pretty built out. So I think that extended upgrade cycle for iPhones and smartphones is here to stay. And that's really what's behind the slow growth at ARM and why they built such a big successful business, but also why they're kind of flatlining now. The other one was super interesting that came out this week was Tesla. So Tesla had its first negative growth in quite a long time. We called that and wrote an article about it. There were kind of two issues with it. The first one is that the EV market itself is just completely saturated and there's a lot of competition coming in. And the second one is that the limitations are really becoming more apparent now. In the United States, Tesla was very early in building a charging network all around the country. But now there's a lot of Teslas. So now you see all these photos of these huge long queues. And I know that's the case in Australia. If you choose to drive up the coast from Sydney to Byron Bay or Queensland, you might be in a long queue waiting to charge your vehicle, which most people just don't want to do. Like, that is not a good spend of time for anybody. The other issue is that the courts in Delaware decided to strip Elon Musk of his compensation. His previous compensation plan, which was an incredibly ambitious one. You know, he had to basically 10x the company, and he did it, and he got, you know, an absolutely historic payout. But a shareholder with like a tiny, I think it was a few hundred dollars of shares or something, sued, obviously funded by lawyers who then put in a multi-billion dollar bid for a payout on the back of it and said it was unfair, even though it was like a legally contracted thing. So went against freedom of contract. But of course, there is precedent. You know, you can't just write a contract for anything. There's plenty of instances where contracts are not valid. But what it does do is it changed things for Elon. You know, he has multiple ways to invest in AI. And it was reported that the head of Vision at Tesla, and there's a bit of controversy over whether he was the head of Vision, but had a title saying that, is moving to X, so Twitter, so Elon Musk's other AI platform, to work on AI there. And it's a real shame because I think what's happening is Elon is kind of clocking off a bit on Tesla. The one thing that would get Tesla moving is if he put all of his AI efforts within the company. And the perfect outcome would be Elon Musk puts all of his AI efforts in Tesla and has another crazy compensation plan where he 10x's the company and gets another huge payout. And that's actually pretty possible. You know, it's a $500 billion company, but there's many multi-trillion dollar companies now. And soon there'll be many more. And the largest companies will at some point hit 10 trillion. So it is possible for him to do it. But the only way he would be able to do that is to do all of his AI efforts within Tesla. So the clear path for the board is to actually incentivize him to do that. But the opposite has happened, not because the board hasn't supported him, because they have, but rather the courts in Delaware have arbitrarily stripped this award and it's still going through the appeal process now. So that's a real shame. But in the meantime, you've got like a company that now has negative year-on-year growth. It's trading relatively richly, so kind of P of 40, 45, depending whether you look at this year or next year. Obviously, next year now includes a contraction. You have immense cheap competition from China. Xiaomi released a car and it's sold out. So you have a very difficult situation for Tesla. So we don't own any shares and you know, if you had to guess, it probably still goes down from here. If you think about it, you know, we used to talk about like customer love and explosive growth. That was when you wanted to own Tesla. And it came through in the numbers. So it had that true customer love and explosive growth. You could see the waiting times online. You could see the margins they were getting. The same way that Apple charged more than everybody else and captured the profit margin of the smartphone industry, Tesla charged a significant premium for their cars and captured significantly more value than the rest of the industry over significant periods of time. That was when it was a great explosive growth, true customer love stock, like selling everything they could make, charging a premium, reinvesting that, growing super fast. That was great. Where we are today doesn't really hit any of those. It's not quite the same. Teslas aren't that kind of glamorous thing that you rarely see that turns heads. I did see the Cybertruck and that was a head turner. So that could be a near-term thing that turns it around. But even then, the reality is most of their revenues will always come from, you know, the cheaper sedan and Model Y that they've got. So I think in that lens, what's going on is pretty rational. The fact the stock price is going down, if you use that old framework, it actually kind of called it when it was going up. And it's also saying now is not the time to own. And I think it does need to come down a fair bit. I mean, what would make us interested? Look, they've obviously got this new self-driving, which is the first one where it's kind of all unsupervised learning. They're just feeding it the controls. So whether the driver brakes, accelerates, turns the wheel, how much, and the input pixels. That's what they're feeding into a model, and they're connecting the two and have built a self-driving module that's completely different to everything else they did in the past. Effectively just wiping out all the work they'd done, but coming up with a much better, more robust product that will get better and better with time. And remember, Tesla doesn't even feed all their data in. It would be impossible if you think about all the different cameras on every single car and all the miles that are driven. But, you know, if a car breaks, they can get all the input data from that period and train it on that. But with time, more and more of that data will go through and that model will just get better and better and better. But what's the end state here? I mean, it's hope. The bull case is they charge something like $1,000 US a month for it. $12,000 US a year is a lot. Like, people buy a car, they don't want to buy a $12,000 a year subscription. And if it's much less than that, then it's not really enough to move the needle on a $500 billion company. And they're talking about trying to license it out to other OEMs, but so far no one's taken the bait. And I don't think they will. I don't think their competitors are going to allow this amazing cash generative business a Tesla to be built off the back of their own installed demand. I mean, I could be wrong, but so far none of them have taken that bait, and it doesn't surprise me from a competitive situation at all. So Tesla's been in a bit of a tight spot. The other thing you can see is you can see secondhand values are absolutely collapsing. So going back to that customer love point, it used to be that they're kind of like iPhones. They held their value very well, but now that's not the case. There's too much supply. It doesn't help that Hertz bought tens of thousands of these things and is selling them en masse because they just weren't suitable for hire cars. You know, if you hire a car, you probably are going on a long drive. It's probably the last situation you want to run out of battery and have to wait a long time in a queue. And also, because the acceleration is so different and more aggressive, apparently there are a lot more front collisions. And because the car's kind of unusual, they're much more expensive to repair. So it just became an economic loser for Hertz. And so they are contributing to this mass supply on the market. All in all, it's not a super exciting story, even though it is down 31% for the year. Speaking of, it's been a bit of a weird year, actually. So ARK is down 10%, WisdomTree Cloud ETF down 4%, Biotech is flat, Small Caps up 1.5%, NASDAQ up 6%. It's been a weird year because it feels like there's been a bull market in a handful of stocks. And we're lucky that, you know, a chunk of our portfolio was in those companies like NVIDIA, to a lesser extent AMD, all the semiconductors basically. Nubank performed well, Celsius performed well. But once you go outside of those handful of winners, it hasn't actually been an easy year at all. Now, as I write, Israel struck an embassy in Lebanon, and apparently Iran is going to send a bunch of missiles towards Israel tonight. So the market had a pretty nasty reversal at the end of yesterday, so that was Thursday. Partly on the back of that, partly on talks that rates won't rise. So it could be a pretty spicy weekend and a pretty hairy Friday or Monday open if things really kick off on the weekend. There was also a speaker came out and said that rate rises probably weren't necessary if inflation stops coming down. Now, that is probably sensible. Like, I don't think you look around and see a need for lower rates. You hear about real estate distress, but real estate prices are going up all around the world. In Australia, largely due to, you know, the 500,000 net migration that's coming in every year versus, say, 120,000 new dwellings that are built. It's bizarre to think what happens. So you've got, let's say in the last quarter, maybe I think it was 130,000 net new people and maybe 35,000 new dwellings. So there's 100,000 net. So where did they go? Presumably they're all just going to share houses and those awful like inner CBD rentals where people rent out rooms to two or three people at once. I don't know, but we do know the people coming in and we know the dwellings being built and we know the people coming in are way in excess of the dwellings being built. Good for real estate, and the stats are that inflation has kind of stopped falling the way it was. And with migration where it is, there's no real prospect of rents, which in the US are basically the only major component of inflation now. It doesn't seem likely that those are actually going to come down. Which means that the case for rate cuts this year is not particularly strong. Now, I don't think it has a huge effect at the moment. There's periods where the market is intensely focused on interest rates, and there's periods where they just don't seem to matter. We've kind of been in a period where it doesn't really matter, though in 2022 it was kind of all that mattered. We're just gonna have to watch that play out. We've got a pretty clear entry and exit signals across our portfolio, so we'll be tracking those closely. In the meantime, I think the play is pretty clear. There's gonna be a continued bull market in semiconductors and the real companies, the real AI companies, the ones that are actually getting that spend. Whereas there's a lot of companies masquerading as AI companies, which and not getting those revenues. They're not seeing that growth. They're not getting the benefit of those economics. That's an easy one. There's the independent kind of growth plays where a company that's just going ballistic, they're going to continue to do well. So for us, that would be Nubank in South America, Celsius, which sells drinks, and a couple of healthcare life sciences plays that for their own reasons are doing exceptionally well. But I think the broader, regardless of what happens in the Middle East, Russia, Ukraine, or the Fed, it does seem like we're due for a bit of a consolidation period. But you know, what could be a likely outcome is actually we sell off now on the back of these Middle East fears and slightly hawkish turn by the Fed just in time for earnings. And then a bunch of companies are going to do really well. I don't think there's been any lack of demand for NVIDIA. We know that the hyperscalers would have done very well. It's pretty clear that earnings will continue to be robust. Another question that's quite interesting is, you know, why wasn't there a recession? Everybody was calling for a recession in 2022. The market sold off the way it would if a recession was coming. But other than those two negative quarters, which by the way, I think counts. I don't think it's some random committee that decides if it's a recession. Two negative quarters is a recession, but they're very mildly negative. So why wasn't there a big downturn and a big historic pullback in aggregate demand? And it's pretty clear when you look at the numbers, and it's kind of obvious to say, but it definitely wasn't obvious to anybody at the time, or certainly nobody that was writing about it. Literally everybody, like there's so many commentators in Australia that were calling for a hectic recession. And the answer is basically there was immense government spending. It was like 6-7% deficit in the US. It was a historic deficit. Like those deficits typically in the past happened during war or recession. And there wasn't a recession, there wasn't a war. I mean, you could argue that 6-7%, like that's kind of what held it up. which is a fair comment and pretty close to the truth. But it's really interesting because it kind of affects the way you think about things going forward. You know, if the Democrats are going to continue to spend, which they will, and run these huge deficits and grow the US national debt, in the near term, that is pretty protective of markets and demand. Similarly, wars, I mean, what's the typical macro response to wars? It's energy prices up, commodity prices up, inflation up, and with time, rates up. That's like the typical recipe. But in the near term, often, obviously, there's a safe haven bid for bonds when things go wrong. So that's kind of what's top of mind. We're still looking at the semiconductor space. Everything we're reading is actually more bullish, if anything. We were very skeptical in AMD just after it doubled. It got more expensive than Nvidia with a fraction of the growth and isn't the market leader. But then, you know, you speak to someone from Meta or Microsoft and all of a sudden they're saying they really are going to massively increase their spend on AMD. Furthermore, when you read about the spend on data centers, so it's worth noting they're also going to upgrade all their existing data centers as well as 3, 4, 5x the amount that they actually have. You know, this is a huge spend. It's going to come regardless of what happens in the macro world. And so I think it's crystal clear, you know, this is just one of those regimes where you kind of know where things are going. That will change at some point. It's not going to last forever. But for now, we know where the investment dollars are going. We know which stock's going to perform. Semiconductors are not trading crazily expensive, given the visibility on the spend and all the dollars that are going to be pumped through that entire ecosystem. So I think that is the play. I think keep it simple, focus on those parts of the market where the most exciting things are happening, where all the investment dollars and CapEx dollars are going to go. And that's a pretty robust approach for this kind of market. I will leave it at that. Thanks for listening.